So, Josie, tell us, what is the idea behind Currency?
Currency is really a project that we embarked upon probably about a year and a half ago when we decided to apply for an NEA grant that was ultimately, you know, part of why we wanted to do this project. I think that Suzanne Sparge, who's the director of 516 Arts, had been thinking about doing an exhibition on the theme of money for some time, and it was spurred by a series of lectures that she had attended that were done by Manuel Montoya, who is actually the co-curator of this exhibition. And if you've ever been to one of his lectures, he's really someone who is expansive in his thinking. He is a professor with the Anderson School, but he's always thinking outside of that particular space that he is in terms of culture and how it relates to our economic realities. And so when we started talking about currency, really the word that we honed in on was value. And, you know, what is it that we value in our everyday lives, and how ultimately are those things impacted by money itself and currency? And so what you'll see in the show is a whole variety of artists and interventions that are really asking questions rather than providing answers. And so the questions that we raise are, you know, how do we value the environment? How do we value culture? How do we value creativity? And through that, we look at several different themes around debt, around work, around time. And so what you'll see is that each of the works that were selected for this show delve into those themes in very multi-layered kinds of ways. It does have a lot of ideas, but it's also about raising questions.
So we're talking currency in terms of money, but also social currency or currency in the art world.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to bring to this particular exhibition. I'm framing it with sort of a Bakhtinian focus, which, you know, his research, he was this wonderful philosopher who talked about the carnival. And carnival in the 18th century in Europe was really the one day of a year where everybody got to misbehave, right? And the world...
That's why I love Mardi Gras.
And the world was turned upside down, right? So whether it was class or gender or how you behave in public or what you got to wear or not wear. But it always raised this question of, is it that world upside down that's the reality? Or is it the reality that's upside down? And so, you know, this concept of a world upside down is something that we wanted to bring to it. So there is a lot of wit in the show in terms of language and meaning. And as you point out, you know, even in the title Currency, there are multiple meanings that are layered in the concept.
We also have Nina Elder here. And Nina, talk about the work that you are doing for the show.
Yeah, so for a long time, my work has focused on mining and how human beings have intervened in huge movements like geologic time or our sense of the future or things like that. And so what I made for this show, it was an inquiry that I'd been involved with for quite some time about meteorites and the fact that meteorites, when they fall to Earth or when they've been found, they are considered sacred objects by almost all indigenous cultures. And there's only one major meteorite in the entire world that's left in the place where it fell, and that's in Namibia in Africa. And there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of meteorites in scientific collections. So what that means is that science museums and the legacy of exploration has extracted very sacred objects from communities, transitioned them from being a sacred object into a scientific specimen, oftentimes cut them up, sliced them up, put them on displays, made them completely unreachable by the community to whom they were once sacred.
So I did not know this. This is fascinating.
Yeah, a lot of people have not considered this. So, and it has an incredible impact on legislative frameworks about what is sacred. There's been many lawsuits, and it led to the formation of NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Repatriation Act, and the International Repatriation Act, which is something that's upheld by the UN. Both of which say that an unmodified natural object cannot be sacred. So something like a meteorite, it's very, very hard to alter a meteorite. You're not going to carve it into something totemic or shaman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to stay its natural form. So there's been no precedent set, and there's been over 10,000 international lawsuits around meteorites. they're very, very important icons. And so what I did was I embarked on a large project of cultural consultation with culture bearers and elders and cultural councils around the world to talk about meteorites. And the three drawings that I'm showing in this exhibit are focusing on Greenlandic meteorites that were stolen from Inuit people in 1896 by Robert Peary. And they were sold to the National Museum of Natural History in New York City, along with six living Inuit people, five of whom died and were turned into anthropological displays.
Robert Peary brought Inuit people back and sold them.
Yes.
To the museum.
Yeah, and he's someone, you know, a large piece of Greenland is named after him. There's a hall of a major museum that's named after him. You know, he's considered a very important person in the expansion of American cartography and knowledge, but at the same time, he's one of the greatest villains of cultural extraction and exploitation.
Can you say a little bit more about how these themes are tying in with these larger ideas of currency?
Absolutely. To me, I think one of the most overlooked things is what is cultural currency and what is cultural capital. And when those come into conflict with each other, there's this idea of, you know, these jagged worldviews colliding. Like there's this idea that we can have this harmonious gearing of the world and everything can work well together. But there's these moments where like science and the extractive needs of science really don't mesh up very well with an indigenous worldview. And there are great examples of how to make it work. But what was happening in the late 1800s and early 1900s is sort of worst case scenario. So, you know, the fact that these meteorites were sold for $40,000, but they're considered invaluable objects. You know, just the way that we talk about our spiritual objects, the way we talk about our spiritual values, those are even linguistically words that have become part of an economic language. And my drawings, they depict a void. They're these almost photorealistic landscapes with what looks like a hole in the middle, and that's where the meteorite once was. And what I learned from doing cultural consultation with around the world with different communities was that they really perceive what's left behind as a void that can't be filled. You know, you cannot replace these objects once they're gone, once they're cut up. And in many circumstances, the communities have been genocided or deeply impacted. So even the community is no longer intact to claim that object. So this idea of the void and who is responsible for filling in a void, it's just, it's really potent. And I can't answer it, but all I can do is just help spread the knowledge that there are these incredible voids that have been left all around the world, mainly in indigenous communities.
And we have Imani here by Skype. I would love to hear about the work that you are doing for the show.
Right. Well, I'm loving this conversation about sacred objects. But with regards to the show, I'm a part of Occupy Museums, which is a collective that formed in the middle of Occupy Wall Street in New York. And we were a group that kind of came out of the arts and culture working groups. At the core of it was this conversation about wealth disparity, income inequality, capitalism, extractivism. There was this recognition that there are financial systems in place in the United States, as well as operating around the world, that are creating unprecedented wealth disparity, and that are extracting resources, labor, land, life itself from what we have come to refer to as the 99%. And Occupy Museums came with this attempt to really look at the so-called art world and understand and challenge the ways that arts institutions are complicit in perpetuating inequity around the world. Ultimately, also looking at the way that art institutions are actually connected to these financial actors who are impoverishing so many of us in this country as well as around the world. So on the boards of major arts institutions, museums across this country, as well as in nations around the world, you have hedge fund CEOs, you have the heads of major banks, you have people really representing all kind of sectors of wealth in society, people connected with telecommunications. What's the problem with that? Well, ultimately, it means that you start to associate with people who are perhaps armed dealers. You have people like the Sacklers on your board, a family that has made its wealth through the development of OxyContin. And as a result, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are addicted to these painkillers. So death fare is a way to really take a look at this massive, complex, kind of overwhelming global economic reality and make it personal and make it possible for individual people who might be feeling various degrees of stress, anxiety, doubt about their position as an artist in a society where, you know, you are told you need to go and get an MFA that's going to cost you perhaps upwards of $100,000. And that, you know, in order to be an artist in society today, it's necessary for you to take on a massive amount of debt. And you come to find out after graduating that that debt is, you know, nearly impossible to pay off. So how does the individual artist kind of make sense of all of this? What kind of economic values are encoded in the artwork that they produce? And how does this debt burden kind of hold back the artist who is really a person in society who is trying to communicate, who is trying to think deeply about their positionality, about identity, about the future? So all of this is compacted in what's ultimately a pretty simple type of visual strategy, which is to literally remove the layer of drywall within an arts institution and install artworks from artists within the studs, in between the supportive studs that hold up that wall. And it's an attempt to on the one hand, visualize the way that this complexity exists literally within the walls of all institutions within our country, within this capitalist system. And then to group these artists according to commonalities in their economic realities. And the attempt is to sort of try to show the way we are all actually united through this debt and perhaps locate possibilities for solidarity and ideally to be able to leverage one's position. So if we all have debt to, say, University of New Mexico, what kind of strength can we find through that unity? How can we come together actually as an interest group, as an advocacy group, as an activist group sort of through that?
I would turn to Josie. Does that mean you're going to have a piece of the wall removed?
Yeah.
And
so,
5 months?
it does. And okay. Actually, the installation will be on our large entry wall. The Debt Fair project is one that we're extremely excited to have be part of this exhibition in some ways because it challenges us all as arts institutions to think about, you know, how is it that we are engaging with artists at an economic level, but also thinking about the actual place where artists are and where they have to exist in an economic way. And so I think debt is something that we tend to not talk about. You know, there's a sense of almost shame in terms of this idea of what our financial situation is. And so, you know, this is one of those components where we're interested in thinking about how do we create a space for dialogue around some of these challenging questions and issues that we all face in our everyday lives. And so, you know, kind of putting a highlight, a lens from the artistic perspective, from the creative perspective, I think adds to that conversation. One of the things that I was so impressed by with the Occupy Museum's collective is the way in which they're really thoughtful in thinking about the communities that they're coming into. So Debt Fair existed as part of a project at Art League Houston and then also as part of the Whitney Biennial in 2017. And so thinking about what it means for different geographic locales and thinking with a specific lens about where it is was one of the pieces that most impressed me in the initial conversations with Imani and the rest of the group. And so it's been really interesting to be part of that kind of collective process and thinking about in the same way that, you know, Nina was talking about her project. Like, so much of the work in this exhibition is really based on artists who have engaged with a very intentional form of research and searching and looking and thinking about where their artwork fits within this conversation, whether we're talking about environmental issues, whether we're talking about specific cultural issues. Nina brought up, you know, sort of the sacred and the profane. And so that's one of the things that makes me excited about the exhibition is the way that each of these artists is so intentional in the way they go about doing their work.
I want to just say that I'm excited for the show to do some education about what it really means to be an artist, because we're functioning in such a weird economic situation, each individual. And I think Debt Fair really does a good job of that. But, you know, no one's buying our materials. Nobody pays an artist to be an artist. I don't get paid to exhibit anything. So it's completely an unremunerated profession, and it's the only one. And I'm really excited to see if this exhibition can provoke new knowledges and promote new change to, if we value arts, we have to start valuing artists. So that's what I'm most excited about with this exhibit.
Fantastic. Well, this is great. It opens on November 17th at 516 Arts in Albuquerque, and it will run through January 26th. And you're going to have events throughout that time, some public forums like financial literacy for artists, forums on the future of work and on museum interventions. I will put a link to 516 Arts at our website.
That's great. And more information can be found at 516arts.org. And thank you for having us. And we really appreciate getting to have the opportunity to talk about currency and what we all value.